And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
It's every man for him or herself these days. Seems everyone's pulling for his or her own future. And it's leading to some pretty amazing and alarming visions of our past and our future. Lots to talk about, from the Chesapeake to chestnuts, cell phones to gorillas. It's all coming up when your Voice of the Earth returns here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Aloha, Hawaii. Welcome to a whole lot of new listeners from the middle of the Pacific Ocean. You know, we live in amazing times. At any time, I can look at a map and see where everyone who's listened in the past couple of weeks is listening from. And I have some great new friends listening in Hawaii because in the last 2 weeks, Hawaii has become my top listening site. So, to say thank you, I'm going to reward all you Paradisians with a special free gift. So here's the deal. To listeners from Hawaii who send me an email with their name and mailing address, I'm going to send one of my pen and ink prints. But you have to get it to me before the end of this weekend. Deadline is January 29th. So send me your name and mailing address to Wildside News at Cox.net. That's WILDSIDENEWS at COX.NET. It's on today's webpage. It's exciting to see that the dream of the Voice of the Earth reaching literally around the world is coming true. I can see from my listener map that I have listeners in most American cities like New York City, Tampa, Colorado Springs, Minneapolis, Chicago. And then I want to send a special aloha to my friends listening in Sydney, Australia, Milano, Italy, Hamburg, Germany, Amsterdam, and The Hague. I'd love to hear from each and every one of you, so I'm encouraging each of you to send me a greeting. Tell me a little bit about yourself, maybe a favorite show, something you'd like to hear about. Send them to wildsidenews at cox.net. It's on today's show page. There is so much happening around the world, and we are creating a global Earth network that can stay informed about the critical issues, who's doing what to help, and of course, just the wonder of our natural world. It's very exciting. So, I want your help. I want you to help the Voice of the Earth spread around the world by inviting five of your friends to listen as well. Let's expand this listenership all the way around the world and reach a million listeners by the end of this year. I need your help. Thanks. Today, we begin with some observations on the newly released film about Pocahontas called The New World. In segment 2, you know those miraculous cell phones we're all becoming dependent on? Well, buried deep inside each phone is a small amount of a metallic mineral called coltan. Seems no one has found a substitute for it yet, and unfortunately, its primary source is found in only one place in the world, and that turns out to be threatening, are you ready for this, to the already struggling populations of lowland gorillas in the Congo. We talk with Karen Kilmer of the San Diego Zoo about the dilemma and what zoos and you can do to help. And then in segment 3, it's a long-term story of hope, a hope that someday the great American chestnut forest that once dominated lands east of the Mississippi may once again be restored. We talk with Marshall Case, president of the American Chestnut Foundation. So, following the news, all you listeners around the world, we take this journey together. So, let's get started with the news. There's a price you pay for success. One of last year's top box office hits was The March of the Penguins, chronicling the unimaginably complex life that emperor penguins endure. Perhaps inspired by the movie or for reasons no one will ever really know, The world shared the grief of two penguin parents whose baby, Tolga, was stolen from the Amazon World Zoo Park in the Isle of Wight. Despite a huge reward for its return, the little penguin has not been heard from. But life must go on, and indeed it is, for Keala and Oscar, who have laid a second egg, due to hatch in 40 days. Zoo officials noticed a return to a more amorous relationship following the loss, and now, voila, life returns to normal. We've all heard of the legendary endangered species that get tied up in massive court battles over habitat destruction versus resource exploitation or development. Who can forget the snail darter or the northern spotted owl? Well, here comes the new kid in the meadow. It's the Preble's meadow jumping mouse. The critter is stirring up quite a controversy suddenly, adding to the debate about the Bush administration's loose interpretation of science in the name of development. Seems a field biologist, Rob Roy Ramey, of the Denver Museum of Nature and Science, declared that the Preble's jumping mouse no longer needed protection, as it was not a distinct species. Ramey was rewarded for his findings by becoming an advisor to the Interior Department in its attempts to reclassify several species whose endangered status is blocking developers. Hold on, however, says Tim King, a USGS conservation geneticist, who says the evidence is quite clear that the Preble's mouse is its own unique species. The Interior Department, under pressure, has agreed to review the findings. So, just hold on a moment up there in Colorado and Wyoming. We mustn't jump to conclusions. Caribou have suddenly become a favorite news item, featured in most reports about ANWR and now the Strategic Petroleum Reserve up in Canada. Wildside News recently did an in-depth feature with the author of Being Caribou, the story of following a herd of 120,000 caribou from summer to wintering grounds in Canada and Alaska. Well, here in the lower 48, the story is quite different. The last remaining caribou herd, numbering perhaps as few as 34, are being driven northward into Canada and may disappear completely from the U.S. mainlands. As if the entire northern tier of the U.S. were not enough room for snowmobilers, it seems that the area along the border between the U.S. and Canada in Idaho, known as the Selkirk Mountains, the last stronghold of caribou, is in reality a critically significant area for snowmobilers to ride, so much so that battle lines are being drawn between lots and lots of people who like animals like caribou, otherwise known as conservationists, and, of course, snowmobilers. Mark Sprengel of the Selkirk Conservation Alliance is quoted as saying that there is no prospect of negotiations. In fact, members have been branded domestic terrorists by some snowmobilers. Leave it to a federal judge in Spokane, Washington, to ban snowmobile trail grooming for the rest of the season in the areas critical to the Selkirk herd to survive. God bless federal judges. We'll have to see how this sorts out in the months ahead. And on the economic front lines, with the recent movement by the Bush administration and a few other nations to renominate nuclear power as the hope for the future, Japanese firms are boosting investments in uranium sources in Central Asia as a revenue stream, since a surge in global demand for nuclear fuel is likely to keep prices at record high levels. A recent announcement about a newly proposed nuclear power plant in the U.S., the first since 1977, is part of this resurgence, which actually will take quite a while to build, as building literally a new nuclear power plant is expected to take 15 years before it can get online. So until then, invest in uranium and get your protective lead underground safety chambers moving, because uranium is back. And that's the news. A few reminders. I'm serious, we need to get 1 million listeners by the end of this year. Do your part. Tell your friends. Send out just 5 emails today with links to the Wild Side News. We'll be happy you did. So now, let's turn to our first feature. Every once in a while, I treat myself to an afternoon at the movies, which is what I did yesterday when, right smack in the middle of the afternoon, I headed to my local Metroplex, plunked down my $6.25 matinee-reduced ticket price to see a new film, The New World. It's a beautiful, idyllic film. It conjures up what we American nature people carry deep in our souls. It harkens back to the original wilderness and the people who lived in a sacred balance. For those who have not heard, it is the telling of the story of Pocahontas, the daughter of a Powhatan chief living along the area now called Chesapeake Bay. We look back and see it as history. The New World makes an attempt to bring it to life in ways that haven't been tried before. The meetings of explorers and natives have happened throughout our history so often that such moments are now part of a list of dying and extinct occurrences on planet Earth. Virtually all the corners have been explored. All the indigenous people are now part of the global community, whether they like it or not. And as we hear daily, the results are uncertain. Amazingly, in the grand American legacy, the story of Pocahontas is part of our mythscape. But it is even more than that, because Pocahontas was not just a great story. She actually lived, and this is her story. It's the story of a beautiful young Indian girl, or maiden, or woman. We must be ever conscious of our need to be politically correct. Or perhaps we can say, a beautiful teenage princess, daughter of Chief Powhatan of the Powhatan Nation. We can't know how it all really happened, but I can wonder how it may have been. And writer-director Terrence Malick gives us his visions of our history. It's because we now know what America has been, how it is now, and for those of us who stay connected to the earth, what it may become, that the moment creates a kaleidoscopic hologram of emotions, which is my term for images and emotions. Pocahontas is played by an amazing 14-year-old actress who looks every bit of Pocahontas, and so too the naturals, as the Native Americans are referred to. Merrick's debut of the film was 15 minutes longer than the version you're likely to see, and many are thankful that he cut the film down to 135 minutes, as it has moments, long moments, when the sound of crickets or bird wings in the deep, deep eastern forests move in front of the action and the actors. At some time I will track down the original cut, because those 15 minutes on the cutting room floor are filled with immersions into the ancient forests and fields, and I want more of it because of who I am. The film evokes at times that sense of the ancient woodlands. One can sometimes feel the aging of the trees in the minimalist moments when those deep forest sounds resonate somewhere deep in our souls. It is, too, the story of the willful establishment of the first English outpost on American soil, and the sense of man and men set against the rigors of a wilderness outpost that in the New World becomes sensory. It is a love story of sorts, barely Hollywood, thank God, and therefore interesting and bold. It is a film that opens thoughts and feelings, much like one feels opening the creaking drawers of an attic bureau of your long-dead grandfather. Some will not like it, so be it. But for me, I crave the chance to crawl back into the soul of our American land, to touch an America that once was, but has long since disappeared. I came home with my pockets filled with memories of things I hoped to know. The New World. Go ahead. See it. Coming up, what do cell phones and gorillas have to do with one another? We find out when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Americans aren't the only people using cell phones these days. As a matter of fact, the whole world is going cellular. But there's a little-known secret about cell phones. It's being felt in a most unusual place. Where? You'll find out when we return with your voice of the earth around the world, here on the Wildside News. Take a moment to try to remember how many cell phones you've owned since cell phones first changed the way we live. And then, pay close attention. The other day I came across an article about the fact that the San Diego Zoo, which is down the road from me here, was starting a program to recycle cell phones. And I thought, well, that's interesting. But the more that I read, the more I found there's a lot more to this story than one can ever imagine. And joining us now from the San Diego Zoo is Karen Kilmer, who is the Associate Curator of Mammals and is going to inform us why it is that recycling cell phones at a zoo actually serves a much more global purpose. Karen, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you very much.
Well, now, what is this about cell phones? And first of all, let's talk about the program and how that works, and then let's get into how it is that this affects things around other sides of the planet.
You know, it's so difficult in this day and age to make an impact sometimes on things that are happening on the other side of the planet, especially when it comes to wildlife and conservation. And what we've found is that obviously there are millions and millions of cell phones being used in the world today. And one of the elements that is found in cell phones is called coltan, and it's a mineral that is mined in Central Africa. Primarily, about 80% of it is done in the Democratic Republic of Congo. This area is also one of the most rich areas of the world in terms of wildlife, whether it's gorillas, bonobo, chimpanzees, a number of different species of birds and antelope and primates. And of course, anytime you have people and animals in close quarters, unfortunately the animals too often come out the losers in the whole situation. And so the mining that's being done is not only destroying habitat, but when you have too often the companies take sort of a irresponsible attitude in terms of providing weapons for the workers so that they can feed themselves, and so they just go out and hunt whatever's available. And so by recycling and reusing the phones that are already in place, we hope to reduce the need for additional mining of coltan. And in fact, the need has been reduced over the last couple of years, but we're looking to reduce it, if not eliminate it, you know, somehow to reuse what we have. And so the cell phone recycling program is just that. People can bring in their phones they're no longer using. They are sent to a company that then refurbishes them and sends them to other areas of the world to use for folks who don't have access to brand new cell phones. So it really is a good program that allows people to make better use of something that may otherwise just go into the trash.
From what I understand, a lot of the mining is done completely illegally. In other words, you have subsistence people who are just trying to figure out how to survive.
Right.
And they can go out and they can mine the coltan and make some money. But unfortunately, in that process, while they're out there, they kill whatever they can. And this leads to the slaughter of, in particular, a very endangered species, the gorillas.
Exactly, yes. And you know, that's the sad part. There certainly is a human element in this that you have people that are making a living, and the only way they, you know, they have available to them for eons, they've hunted to feed themselves to begin with. But when you have so many additional people, when you're talking 100,000 miners show up in an area where there may have been, a few thousand people living normally,
wow.
And all of those people need to be fed, then the impact just gets totally out of proportion, and it not only creates, destroys the animals obviously to begin with, but once the mining's done and those people have to go back to living in that area, then they no longer have, access to what they had before to survive. So the long term impact, impacts the people also. So that's the sad part of this whole thing. There's victims, both human and wildlife.
I guess the real challenge is the fact that this coltan is very important in terms of cell phones. It has a quality that no other mineral has.
Apparently not. Yeah, I know there has been research to find something to replace it, but apparently it's something that provides a electrical conduit of some sort. That it has elements that just they haven't figured out anything else that does it as well as the coltan does.
The sad part about that is the fact that cell phone usage is becoming, wired phones are becoming a thing of the past, particularly in the developing world.
Right.
So the demand for cell phones is going to only increase, and I don't know how we resolve this, and I guess that's really this cell phone recycling program is trying to address that.
Mm-hmm.
By, if enough people were to bring phones to these recycling centers and get them to the recyclers, there's two aspects of it. One is that the phones can literally be refurbished and then sent out as alternatives to buying new phones, therefore you're recycling that coltan.
Correct.
And or they can, if the phone is dysfunctional, they can tear the coltan out and other elements and get that to the manufacturers so that they can use it and therefore hopefully reduce
some
of the usage. So how do people recycle the phone? I mean, how are they going to know how to do this?
Well, we're trying to get the word out. There actually are 46 zoos in this country now who are participating in this program, and it's as simple as there's a drop box, if you will, near the entrance to the zoo, and people come in and if they can't find it, ask somebody.
Yeah.
we're more than willing to direct people and so they can participate in this, and we will make sure that the phone gets recycled or as you say, reused in some fashion. Mm-hmm. The other side of this is people need to recognize that there are a number of elements in cell phones that are potentially, hazardous chemicals and toxic waste. And when you put that into our own trash areas, that just, contributes to causing problems in our own environment. So this is really a win-win-win situation all the way around if people would just take a few extra moments to recycle their cell phones.
And that's very important because landfills are actually, these toxic chemicals and elements get into the landfill and the rains carry these down into our water tables, and we are affected by that. I know in San Diego they've just passed a law that says we can no longer put these things into our landfills.
Exactly.
And so, and that's a good thing. It's my girlfriend and I were the other day trying to figure out what do we do with the old batteries, and
yeah.
So we're working on that. But it is very important. Do you know if any cell phone is acceptable?
As far as I know, yes. Uh-huh. Any cell phone is acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So just bring them by, and I think there's like some sort of a bin or something that people can dump them into.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, at the front of the zoo, yes.
Well, this is very interesting, and it actually brings up this issue of the interconnectedness of our lifestyles and the wild creatures. I certainly encourage everybody to do this. They can find a zoo near them and probably call and find out if they should bring their phone and mm-hmm. participate, because it will make a difference. Are there other things that you'd want to just share with us because we have this opportunity in terms of your work?
Well, I think any time people can educate themselves on the connection between what they do and what they consume. Obviously, we in the United States are huge consumers. we like to buy things. People need to recognize that there are really a number of ways that we can be more responsible in our behaviors that actually do have some impact It can ripple literally around the world in terms of reducing the impact, the negative impact on other areas of the world. So whether it's, you know, looking for wood products that have been responsibly logged.
Like the FSC program.
Correct, uh-huh. And knowing that you're not buying something that destroyed virgin forests or destroyed habitat. The orangutan in Asia right now, in Southeast Asia, is a big issue in terms of habitat destruction. And a lot of that is due to logging. Logging also is having a huge impact in Africa. So, you know, there are a number of ways, and there are a number of good websites that I think people can go to get information. You can look on the San Diego Zoo website. We have a number of, you know, recommended connections and information on how people can get more information. So,
talk a little bit about the status of the lowland gorilla. From what I understand, within the last 5 years, their population has been dramatically impacted.
Oh, it's unfortunately plummeted, you know, not only because of mining and logging, what's called the bushmeat trade, which is the illegal killing and eating of wildlife, has increased dramatically over the last decade, primarily because of these other activities that have brought so many people into these areas. And unfortunately, you know, so many of these companies don't take responsibility for conscientiously, you know, taking care of their workers, and so they send them out to hunt. And then on top of that, then there's the disease issue. You know, many people have heard of the Ebola virus problem, and that certainly has killed a number of people in Africa. But just over the last couple of years, they've also discovered it's killing gorillas, it's killing chimpanzees. So, you know, there's a number of issues. Our closest relative here, you know, deals with and all of the same issues that we deal with in terms of survival. And right now, the deck stacked against the gorillas and the chimpanzees and the bonobo, unfortunately. And
well, there's some frightening predictions about how long these animals may actually survive. And I hate to hear about them, but why don't you lay it on the line for us? I think we just have to share this realization, and then we have to absolutely either do something or give up.
Right.
Because if we don't take action, these animals that I grew up loving and everybody that I know, we took them for granted in many respects. They could literally be gone, and it's a thought that is extremely painful and difficult for me to deal with.
It's tragic. Yeah, I mean, there are experts that are now saying that if we don't make significant changes in how we care for these species and manage these areas and reduce the human impact in these areas, that we could literally lose gorillas, bonobo, orangutan within the next 10 to 20 years. And that's just, you know, I can't even get my mind around that, that could happen.
One of the things that frightens me is the fact that these numbers keep decreasing.
Yeah.
And then we hear about a new problem that dramatically impacts even those estimates.
Right.
I mean,
right.
We could wake up and there could be an Ebola outbreak in some of these areas or other things.
Yes.
And, you know, there has to be a population large enough to maintain the species, and it's getting to the point where those populations are so small and so critical that perhaps that is the problem. There just aren't enough of these species to maintain the population.
Shelves going, yeah. Well, there's a study that just came out, and I have not had a chance to read it at length, but it just came out in the last couple of days, essentially saying that about orangutans, that it's looking like we have reduced the numbers, you know, our human activity has had such an impact that's reduced the numbers of orangutans so far that perhaps genetically they can't recover.
Right.
And certainly, you know, that's going to be the case with the other species also, that you're correct. You know, once you get to, and you know, that's the challenge that, you know, that we see in zoo management. When you deal with small populations, you have to be very careful, and it's very difficult to keep small populations going because of, you know, when you start getting inbreeding and the health of the population suffers just from that, much less, you know, whatever else is having impact on the population.
We're talking with Karen Kilmer, who's the associate curator of mammals at the San Diego Zoo. Karen, okay, let's say that you were made queen of the world, okay?
Okay.
And that you could, I don't know if it's mandate or woman date, but however you want to put that, you could create an edict to make changes. I mean, let's just fantasize here. What would help? I don't have any answers anymore. I mean, what could we do? For example, if I were to just think out of the box here, I'd say, well, we just need to, something as strange as making sure that the workers have food may dramatically impact these kinds of things. To literally identify and contact those mining companies and say, look, here's care packages. This is our way of helping you. Please make sure that your workers are fed. That would be an idea that I would have. I'm just curious what some of you, but you are really involved in this. What are some of your thoughts on this?
Oh, goodness. That's like being queen for a day here. You referred to the connections between, and that's, you know, the complexities of if we weren't fighting so many wars, if there was more peace in the world, then, you know, we could deal with the poverty that causes so much of this impact. If there wasn't, you know, so much out of control consumerism, you know, we could deal with companies that didn't have to go wipe out forest all over the world.
You're the queen. You can order.
With the consumerism, you know. So,
what would you order? Let's go ahead. Lay a couple of ideas on the table, for fun.
You know,
because I think we have to really think out of the box. I think we've got to quit trying to be so careful, and we all have to do that. We've been conditioned and trained to do that, and rightfully so.
Oh, very definitely, yeah. I mean, you know, it's a politics side of things. You know, everybody's trying to be so political, and so you know, and you try to be sensitive, and it becomes very difficult.
But go ahead now. You forget all that, and let's talk about what needs to be done.
Well, I think really the bottom line, as you know, I've said for a number of years, and certainly it's not a new thought. Other people have said this too. When you're talking about conservation of wildlife, you're really talking about a human issue. It's the animals will survive if you leave them alone. You know, they're out there, but conservation is really about people, and it's about providing people with an acceptable level of survival and living, you know, beyond survival, that will allow them to not have to impact wildlife, that will allow them to have enough to eat, that will allow them to have a quality of life that doesn't force them essentially to compete with the wildlife. And it's, you know, it's people. You know, unfortunately, in this country, we've become so disconnected from the natural world that it's very difficult. You know, that's one of our biggest challenges in educating people, is to really get them to understand what most other people in the world deal with in terms of day-to-day, you know, survival, and how that, impacts the rest of the natural world, whether it's people that have to make a living, have to feed families, need jobs. As I said before, when it was just people feeding themselves and it was sort of a one-on-one relationship with nature, nature can deal with that. You know, that allows recuperation. But when it's hundreds of thousands of people and you know that additional impact is what then starts the downward spiral.
Well, and actually that's how we started this conversation, is the effect on how it is that our amazing devices, these little cell phones, are dramatically impacting gorilla populations, perhaps to the point that they will become extinct. I realize you've got to move on. Karen Kilmer, Associate Curator of Mammals at the San Diego Zoo, I hope we have a chance to talk again. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Do it. Dig them out of your drawers and closet and get them into the hands of your local zoo. They'll know what to do. Tell your mama, tell your pa, your lover, and your friends to do the same. When we return, a story of great hope, here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Imagine a world of grand large trees, a deciduous forest that covers much of the East Coast with giant 120-foot behemoths with trunks of 6, 10, 12, and 15 feet and more in diameter. Then imagine them gone. We talk about the great American chestnut forest, their past, and their hope-filled future when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wildside News. In the past 401 years since Pocahontas and John Smith met, much has happened to our American lands. In many cases, the departure of our forests and wild places has come with the advances of the modern world, and in some cases, nature herself played a role. That is the case with the story of the great American chestnut forests. It is a story now of hope, thanks to a small group of dedicated chestnut lovers who are growing into a mature forest of hope. Joining us now from Bennington, Vermont, is one of my better friends. We go back a long ways. We're a couple of true nature guys, grew up with it. We have a lot in common. Marshall Case is the president of the American Chestnut Foundation. Marshall, welcome to the Wildside News.
Good to be back in touch, Sydney. I think we did the first program together. You used me as your guinea pig.
That's what friends are for.
That's right. Well, we still know how to roll up our pant legs and wade out catching frogs together. That's what counts in life.
Well, I wish there were a few more frogs. They're harder to find right now, and that's part of why we keep working so hard.
And they are disappearing faster than we can log them in the new territories.
That's really sad, because you're a frog guy.
That's right.
Yeah.
Particularly the tree kind, the hylas. I like the hylas the most.
Well, speaking of trees, that seems to be one of the main foci of your life these days. And you're the president of the American Chestnut Foundation. And for people who aren't aware of that, why don't you give us an overview of what you're up to?
Well, we have a modest job to restore 4 billion American chestnut trees to the eastern forest ecosystem. For those who aren't familiar with the story, in the early 1900s, a blight fungus came in on Asian nursery stock. It was discovered in 1904 at the Bronx Zoo on some trees that were planted there. And within a 50-year period, this fungus had stretched its way north to the Canadian border and south to Georgia, Alabama, west of the Ohio River Valley, and knocked out the most dominant tree ever in the eastern hardwood forest called the American chestnut. So our job is to find the science and get enough genes for resistance built into the tree material we're working with right now so that we can restore American chestnut to the forest ecosystem here in the east.
The American chestnut tree was a truly dominant tree and created a magnificent forest, one that very few Americans have any concept of and have had no experience ever seeing. Why don't you give us a sense of what that forest was like, because it was a very impressive space.
It was approximately 25% of all the eastern forest on average, and these trees could get to a height of 120 feet, and it was not uncommon to have a diameter of 6 feet up to 12 feet in forest, particularly in the central and southern part of the Appalachians, so from Pennsylvania down to particularly to western North Carolina into eastern Tennessee. And in fact, in western North Carolina, there's a tree from the root collar that was left, not the standing tree, that was 17 and a half feet in diameter, which is kind of hard to believe. These trees were also called the redwoods of the east because they had a high tannin content, and once they were down, used for building materials, for sills in a house, or railroad ties, telephone poles, they lasted a long time. In fact, there's still some American chestnut trees in service have one out on Cape Cod in Massachusetts. I think it was put in service back around 1917 and is still there in the Chatham area out near the eastern end of Cape Cod. So it was called a cradle-to-grave tree. You could do everything with it. And it was a veneer. It was structurally the best wood you could have, lighter and stronger than oak. And it also, of course, supplied a huge amount of nuts each fall. About 50%, a little bit more than 50% of all of the nuts that you would collect on a forest floor on average were American chestnuts. So with the demise of the tree, that resulted in a crash of a lot of the wildlife populations. And it was a tree that actually sustained villages and mountain communities. And when it was gone, many of these mountain people had to move to, you know, city areas, find jobs elsewhere, because this tree actually sustained their entire life.
Do we have an idea of how old some of those old growth chestnuts were?
Well, we know they got to be 400 years. That's the one number that I've seen. In the literature. So a 400-year-old tree, maybe more than that, but at least a 400-year-old.
Phenomenal trees. I encourage people to go to the website and see some historic pictures of some of the trees. They're fascinating. Well, that was then, and this is now. At this point, are there any mature chestnut forests available for people to visit?
No, there are a few on private property, but they're beyond the original range of the blight. So in other words, the trees that were carried, nuts that were carried by pioneers that went beyond the original range, and I'm talking right now one specific area up in northwest Wisconsin, close to where you and I visited at that time. We drove over across the Mississippi together,
mm-hmm.
and up in La Crosse, Wisconsin, so going toward the central northern part of the state, there has been a self-generating forest there, but unfortunately blight found its way into it probably about 10 years ago. We've got ongoing studies at that site. We actually have leases on the property with the farmers in order to protect the trees from being taken down for, you know, commercial use, because it's a very valuable tree. Even in the state of being dead, it's what's called wormy chestnut, and it's a very highly prized wood now for interior decorating, paneling, and that kind of thing. So we've been studying this, but aside from that, and several others in Michigan and one or two in Wisconsin, small forested areas, all on private land, there are no chestnut forests left in the original range. And there are individual trees, and that's one of our jobs, is to seek out a tree that gets beyond the flower, to or beyond the flowering point, and does not get attacked immediately by the blight. And when we find a tree like that, we try to beat the fungus by getting the pollination from our advanced genetic material that we're growing on our research farms in Virginia, and get the male pollen onto the female flowers on those trees so that we can capture the genetics by getting a nut harvest before fungus kills them. And that's part of our program in developing a statewide chapter network. We now have 13 state chapters and a huge network of volunteers who are out in the field looking for trees, and then if one is found and it gets to the flowering state, they help with the pollination, the harvest, and then the beginning of an orchard program where you're growing new trees up from these nuts in order to continue to protect the biological diversity that still remains within the original range. So there are a lot of sprouts that come up from the old root collars, the old root systems, but hardly any of those, and there are millions of those, and hardly any of those ever get to the point where they flower, because they're attacked by the blight within 3 to 5 years, or by the time they get to be maybe 12 to 15 feet in height.
You've been working on research to develop a resistant strain. How is that progressing?
Actually, we made very good progress. We're within three seasons, I guess, now, of having the first nuts from what we think will be very highly resistant material. These will be very small numbers, of course, to start with. And it's a matter of time now. We're trying to build additional genes for resistance. We know we have two or three genes for resistance to the blight, but we know once we get our material out in the forest that the fungus will do everything it can to overcome what we're throwing at it, for lack of a better term. And so the more genes we can build into our science that can resist the fungus, the better opportunity we have for a long-term solution. So we're still a long window. We're looking at, I would say, for trees that will be blight resistant and, say, 100 feet in height, maybe 12 inches in diameter, we're looking 50 years out. So it's a long view, and but that's part of what you do in science. There are really no quick fixes to a solution like this. The great news is that if and when this happens, we're pretty confident it will, it'll be the greatest comeback story, you know, bringing a species back from the brink of extinction. So it's very encouraging, and it's why a lot of people are getting involved, because they see the hope connected to it. It's not a last-minute crash, save this. It's a long view. The science is working. This can be done. And once we restore it, it benefits lots of things, you know, wildlife, forest health, even purifying the air and the water. This tree has many capabilities.
I heard recently that you are working closely now with the U.S. Forest Service on long-range plans for reintroduction.
Yeah, that's been a major breakthrough for us. Probably 7-8 years ago, we weren't really taken that seriously by the science community in general. And there were people who were paying attention to what we were doing and very intrigued by it, but I thought this was maybe more of a mom-pa kind of an operation by a small nonprofit that would sizzle. Not so. We've developed material now to the point where the USDA Forest Service came to us a little over a year ago, Chief Dale Bosworth and some of his forest health section scientists, and we sat down with him in Washington and at their invitation, and he was so impressed with, first of all, our network of citizen scientists, our volunteers through the chapter network, and what he could see Chestnut could do again for forest health, that within a year, we had a signed agreement. And it's basically a 30-year window with them. So we're looking at 3 10-year phases, and we're working directly with their science team in the field, with their staff geneticists that coordinate the two different regions in the east, and then right on the ground with the Forest Service units. And the plan is to consistently stay out ahead of where we need to be next. So by that I mean looking at early forest trials. We get some material that we think is going to be very good, but we don't want to broadcast it yet because we're not sure how well it's going to do under natural conditions. And so we'll work with various units of the Forest Service to put these experimental plots out with modest numbers of advanced blight-resistant seed and see how they do in these natural conditions. And from that, we'll learn more about the second phase as we get into the second 10-year period with them on how to then begin some small trials in larger areas. And the step up is to get within a roughly a 30-year window with the Forest Service. We want to get to the point where we have material available to the public. And that's the goal. We want to protect the science, do the best job we can, but have some kind of a realistic window where there will be material in the hands of the public, and they can begin to experiment and help with the larger reforestation program.
Now, there's sort of two approaches. One is just the literal reforestation to bring the chestnut back into its original native groves and areas. But as well, there is sort of an applied science to utilizing and realizing that the chestnuts can serve a role in carbon sequestration,
right,
which is the capturing of carbon, which is so important right now in terms of global warming. And then as well, there's visions of utilizing the chestnut for reforesting areas that have been essentially devastated due to strip mining of coal. Why don't you talk about some of those visions?
The carbon sequestration is probably the easier one. First of all, for those people who don't know about this, and I didn't know about it probably until 6-7 years ago, there's something called carbon credits. So in the utility industry, if you have older generating plants, say in the Ohio River Valley, and they're not meeting the standards for the, you know, the U.S. Air quality standards, you can buy land, as an example, in Bolivia, and you buy 1 million or 2 million acres of forested area in Bolivia. Those trees are putting pure air out from that area, and so that's considered an offset to the problem that's being created by the utility company, say, in the Ohio River Valley. So it's an offset, carbon credits, they call them. The good thing, and looking to the future, the good thing about American chestnut is that it grows through science studies we've done at this area up in Wisconsin we were speaking about a few minutes ago. We know that chestnut will grow 2 to 2.5 times faster than any other hardwood tree in the ecosystem in the East. So that means that they can sequester carbon, or it's a carbon sink. You know, they can actually capture it and store it to a level where planting more chestnut gives you more carbon sink, and therefore you're helping with the overall air standard issue. And we have the science to back that up, so it's a matter of time when we can get numbers of trees out there to begin to, you know, help the formula. We go over to the strip mine areas, the coal fields, which in a lot of areas, you know, they're like a moonscape. Under the original guidelines, following up on the years when the strip mining issue was being dealt with, particularly by environmental groups, the regulations actually had the land after it was stripped being built into a kind of a grassland. So you would compact the soil and kind of encapsulate the areas that had been stripped. And then in order to get that soil to hold without a lot of erosion, they were planting very aggressive grass species, which are about the best thing for trying to keep the soil from eroding. The problem was that they came into a situation with almost like concrete. The water would get down, it would run off. The grass species were not good for our native wildlife. You know, there are a lot of problems with that. So we've been doing some early, when I say we, Chestnut Foundation's come into this formula fairly recently. The University of Kentucky in particular, working with the Office of Surface Mining and their regulatory unit, have been doing some experimental plantings in parts of Kentucky, particularly eastern Kentucky. And with the early material, this goes back about 9 years, and with some of our chestnut material in the last 4 or 5 years, and these would be either pure American, or which would be susceptible to blight, or trees that have some resistance built in from our science, we find that chestnut in particular, among the hardwood species, is very, very aggressive in these formerly coal mined areas. And what they do is they go in and they rip the land. Actually, it doesn't look as nice originally because you go in and you rip it one way and you rip it the other way, so you're actually upheaving the land. But it opens up these crevices, and chestnut sends down a deep taproot. That's one of the keys to success. So it reaches for the nourishment, it reaches for the water, and it's very aggressive on these sites. It actually does well in these areas. So we're helping now with a larger program that's Southern Appalachian Reforestation Initiative, what it's called. And we're working through the University of Kentucky and with the Office of Surface Mining Regulatory Unit, which regulates the use of these lands, and then connected to them, the coal industry, to try to recover hundreds of thousands of acres eventually of this land that has really just been sitting there with no benefit to the environment. And we already know from some of the early experiments, Starfire, which is one of the big operations in eastern Kentucky, there are elk in that area now, wild turkey, grouse, goshawks, the food chains begin to work again. So we're very excited to be part of a solution. You know, we're not part of the regulatory part. That's out of our hands. But we're part of a solution to help recover the land. And along with it, come into water purification, wildlife benefit. And this looks very promising for the future. So as you can tell, I'm pretty excited about it.
It has great potential to restore land that has been totally disturbed and really serves no useful function except to grow grass, to beautiful forests that are full ecosystems. That's very exciting work. A few years off, but I commend you for that effort. Now, in terms of people listening, now there's probably any number of reasons why people would be interested in learning more about the American Chestnut Foundation. One may be just because the trees themselves are so interesting and so fascinating and beautiful. Other people may have an interest because in the future they may see chestnuts in their own areas. Specifically, what regions of the country will be benefiting in the future from your efforts at restoring chestnut forests so that those people can get in touch with you and participate?
Well, chestnut could grow most anywhere. I mean, a lot of nuts were carried out to the West Coast. There's some very large trees out there, but they're not part of our program because we're focused on reforestation of the, you know, the original eastern forest. So the main focus for people would be in the east. In terms of helping the overall program, it's just like when the easterners helped the redwood situation, you know, we welcome everybody to help us bring these magnificent trees back east of the Mississippi. If they go onto our website, which is pretty easy, it's acf.org, so American Chestnut Foundation, acf.org. If they have grandchildren or young children, we have a link on our site there to Charlie Chestnut, which is a really wonderful interactive youth program. And there's a good storyline here where Charlie is trying to save, Charlie the Chestnut, is trying to save Grandmother Tree, who's dying of the blight. And it gets into some really good science. There's, you know, math, English, geography, history. Very good program. Basically targeted to third through eighth grade, but there are many college professors using this now in forestry programs because it's a classic story. And you can actually adapt our web program to any age level. So I'd say there are a lot of interests. One is it's good for the soul, of course, just to bring this tree back. It's a good thing to get involved in from that standpoint. It's going to be good for the economy. Because this will help displace a lot of the wood that currently is on the market that has carcinogens in it. We read about this on a regular basis. Chestnut will be a natural wood, naturally rot resistant. So for poles and rails and all those things you'd use around a farm or a yard or a ranch, this will be a good material to bring back. It also will help soften the blow, we hope, on the taking of some of the trees from the Amazon as one example. Because it's such a wonderful veneer, this tree is one of the most beautiful woods you can work with. Furniture makers love it. And then you get into the air purification and other areas, including wildlife. If people like wildlife, if they help bring the tree back, they're going to have a wildlife boom connected to it. And so that's all good. There are many reasons to be involved. It's going to make us better as a country. I mean, it sounds like a big thing to say, but it actually is. I mean, if you look at 25% of the forest, if we can recover that at some point with this tree that has so many qualities, we're doing many things. It's good for people, it's good for the economy, it's good for wildlife, and it just feels good.
You know, we hear so many stories about the demise of our ecosystems and the animals and wildlife. It creates a bit of a blight on our vision. Your story actually is a very positive one, and it gives me hope for a much, much clearer vision that can restore beauty and wholeness to our environment. Marshall, again, give your website.
Okay, it's ACF, for American Chestnut Foundation, .org. If you don't remember that, just punch in chestnut into Google or whatever your search is, and we're likely to come up right at the top of the list, and you'll make your way to our foundation that way. It's a good website. You'll enjoy it. Very interactive, very interesting.
Marshall, I want to thank you for adding your voice to the Wildside News.
Thank you, Sydney. Good to get together again. Look forward to the next time.
Please help spread your voice of the earth around the world as each Thursday and any time on the archives, all of us who work and live each day as if it matters, unite our visions to restore the wonder. This is Sydney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again here on the Wild Side News.